The effort hasn't been involved in booze. It hasn't been involved in changing your attitude. We haven't been focused on the problem of booze. Because that we've put no effort on that. Our effort has been toward, I was saying earlier, taking out the trash, which is part of the spiritual awakening process. That's where we've been focused on. We don't focus on the problem. We focus on the solution. If the solution were contained in the problem, we would have found it already, because we've been focused on the problem for decades. Yeah, so it's a change of focus. Next paragraph. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve. A reprieve, if you look it up, is a stay of execution. A daily reprieve contingent, that means based on, the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I spotted that when I was about 6 months sober. And I said, all right, there it is. What I'm going to do is to find out what that spiritual condition is. I'm going to attain that. And then I'll be able to get what I've always wanted, and that's to take the rest of my life off with pay. I thought, I'm going to get that, and I won't have to do anything else. And I searched for over a year before I found the definition of that spiritual condition. It is, by the way, the next sentence. I didn't think to look there. Every day is a day when we must. There are no musts in the program. You'll hear that. This is one of them. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision, that's the best I can see, of God's will into all of our activities. Well, there aren't any holes in that, are there? I don't get any days off. I don't get any activities off. That's simple. And it's not something I can attain. It's continuous. Page 164 for just a second. Four lines from the bottom. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Doesn't say to. It says of. The road is the destiny. It's today. This is the happy destiny. Don't look for it out there. We're not on the way to it. We're living in it. Back to 85. And then here's the second prayer. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts, so that must be a silent prayer, which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, Bill did get directions in here, didn't he? Yeah. We've begun to sense the flow of his spirit into us. To some extent, we become God conscious. How's that for a promise? We've begun to develop this vital, right, there it is again, vital sixth sense. I heard a fellow with 6 months say, if I'm still using my other five senses trying to get my will, I won't develop this vital sixth sense. That's a pretty good piece of information. But we must go further. And I'll go ahead and start just a little bit on step 11 before we take the break. Turning the page, top of 88, the evening inventory, to retire at night, constructively review our day. I don't have permission to bash myself here. Constructively review our day. Where were we? Resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid. There's that list again. Do we owe an apology? Kept anything to ourselves we should discuss with someone? The question is, what could I have done better? Have I done harm I need to repair? And what could I have done better? And it's really that simple. And it needs to be the last thing I do. And I'd like to note, too, do y'all use the term around here, next right thing? Do y'all say that? You need to do the next right thing? I discovered a last right thing. Each day there's a last right thing. For me, it is to go to bed at an hour so that I can get a full night's sleep and be able to get up in the morning in time to start my day on a spiritual basis. I need to read my 2 pages in the big book I read from non-conference-proof spiritual literature. I do prayer and meditation. I need to have time to do all those things. And if I don't do the last right thing tonight, I won't be able to start tomorrow morning with the first right thing. Yeah. Next paragraph, on awakening. I'd like to observe what it does not say. It does not say after a shower and shave, a half a pot of coffee, two over easy with ham and reading the front page. It says on awakening. That's right now. I got a friend that says his disease gets up 20 minutes before he does every morning. Does some push-ups, some jumping jacks, wakes up on the headboard of the bed. As soon as his eyes open, he goes, "Rawr!" and jumps on him. And he wakes up with untreated alcoholism. and I have to start on awakening. I got a good friend, one of my mentors, says that it's on awakening because I'm capable of making life-devastating decisions between the bed and the bathroom. So I got to treat it right now. I think that's important. I bought this exceptionally ugly watch. I have better taste than this, and I want you to know that. But I bought this watch because it has a function I can't find anywhere else. It has multiple alarms. This morning I had them set 10 minutes apart. And usually I'll set them anywhere between 10 and 20 minutes apart. When the second one goes off, it's the get-up time. When the first one goes off, Miss Linda and I cuddle, and we do our morning prayers in each other's arms. Uh-huh. Let me tell you something. I think if the whole world started their day that way, it'd be a better planet. It really would. I'll grant you that there are mornings when that second alarm wakes us both up. I'll give you that. That happens. It says sought through prayer and meditation. It does not say achieved through prayer and meditation. I'm responsible only for trying to take the action. That's my only responsibility. And I'm telling you, I sincerely believe that those mornings when the alarm goes off the second time and wakes us both up and we slept through our prayers are every bit as good as the mornings when they don't, because we sought. And that's all we were responsible for doing. We saw it. Typically, we get up on the second alarm. I get a shower and shave. She starts the coffee. We meet on the sofa. She does her reading. I do mine. And we do morning meditation together. And we close our days in a similar fashion. A lot of times on the close of the day, we name individuals. We'll lie in the bed and pray. And we'll name individuals that we know that seem to be in need of some prayer. I sponsor a fellow whose brother's name is William, who's missing in action. One of us missing in alcoholism action. If you get the chance to pray for William, he's somewhere in London, we think. We'd appreciate that. Those kinds of things. People around us that are in need of prayer energy. And we don't instruct God on how to fix them. I don't do that. I just hold them up in love. And part of what I do, too, and I learned this also from Miss Linda, if y'all have not heard my wife, you need to do yourself a big favor. She is something. Is I learned that I can send love. Love is a commodity that can be transmitted. And I sent love this morning to the room I was in. I sent it to the restaurant. I sent it to this room. I filled this room flat full of love, lying in my bed this morning between the alarms. My trip to the airport, at the airport, on the plane, and home, the trip home, and at home. And I sent love to the places I'm going to be today. I also sent it to the places my wife's going to be. And I send it there so there'll be some there when I get there. And if you haven't tried that, you might do yourself a favor. I'm going to tell you a story. I had an assistant for a number of years, and she was a very, very, very spiritual Christian woman. And she and I found ourselves talking bad about a particular person we had to deal with on a regular basis. Had a lot of power in our lives. I'm a manufacturer's rep. I'm a multi-line rep. And there was a power broker at our biggest factory, represented a third of my income. And I guarantee you that woman was something. If there wasn't a broom parked in their parking lot, I swear there had to have been. And she and I finally caught ourselves talking bad about this woman and said, wait, we don't believe in that. And we decided, and we started the next morning, and we opened our office with 5 minutes of prayer, sending love to this woman. And the way I do that is I get a mental image of her suspended in space. God's love is flowing down through me and out my chest and swirling around her, this wonderful white stuff. And that's just what I do. What you do, I think, is perfect. And we started doing it, and 3 days later, this woman is calling our office to chat, to find out how we're doing, and gee, aren't you guys fun? 3 months later, at the National Trade Show, I walked into the meeting. There were 200 people in the room. She was knocking people down to get to me, to tell me I was her favorite rep and how great it was to do business with me and Sheila. Yeah. Yeah. Don't doubt the power of love, and don't doubt the ability to send it. I'm going to share another gift from my wife, and she tells us better than I do, but this is her third marriage, my second. And we have a problem, and we have had a problem with ghosts in the bedroom. All right? You understand what I mean? Okay. And she prayed about that, and she was given a gift. And the gift is, before we're going to have what she calls a physical exchange, she prays this prayer. And she says, God, help me stay in the moment. That's all. is help me stay here right now. And it takes care of all of her history and mine. And it takes care of wondering about tomorrow morning, as you know, was it really okay? And, you know, as she noticed, I've gained weight and all that kind of stuff. It just takes all that away. Takes all that away. And I share it just in case somebody can use it. I'll tell you one more story and we'll take a break. When I was, I guess about 5 years ago, a young fellow that I sponsor came into my beloved home group, the back room in Nashville. They meet on Saturday and Sunday mornings to be there. And he'd just come back from his grandfather's funeral. And he had told his grandmother at the funeral, he said it occurred to him, and he told her, he said, I think you were a fabulous wife to my grandfather. And she said, I should have been. I prayed to be that every day. And boy, that hit me hard. And so I thought about that, and I started the next morning, and I don't think I've missed a morning since then. And the prayer that I use is I ask God to help me treasure Linda today. The word treasure is mostly used in the English language as a noun. You understand it as a verb, but we don't use it that way too often. And I started that within 2 weeks. I was walking through the den one day, and she was talking on the phone, and I heard her telling someone, Scott treasures me. When I ask God for what he wants me to have, I get an awful lot of help. It's always about me getting to the right question. He's got the right answer. It's always about me getting to the right question. We're going to come back at 7:45.
Still Bob, still alcoholic. Someone had, I was talking to someone during the break, and we're talking about amends. Just briefly before I get into 10 and 11. How do you know who should be on your 8-step list? Well, the book says it's the people from our 4th step. But I'll give you a good rule of thumb that's, if we're talking about mending separation between me and God's kids, then a good rule of thumb is if you look back over the people in your life and you run in, and anyone that you can't picture sitting in a car with driving cross country for 8 hours, if the idea of any individual spending that kind of time alone with them makes you crazy, they should be on your 8-step list. Right? Because there's some separation between you and that person. Now, sometimes the answer isn't, sometimes it's paying them money, you owe them something. Maybe you owe them some, you have a debt to them, you have unresolved business. Maybe it's just to forgive them for being who they are, allowing them to be what they are. Maybe it's just simply saying some things to them that you've never said to them. You're not even with them, right? So there's a state of separation. Do you ever take two magnets and turn the one around and try to put them together and they just, right? That's what's going on, right? You can feel it. Do you ever go into a meeting or a family event or something and there's a person there that you're not even with? You know what I do? I caught myself. I have this blank spot right about here, and I will always keep them right there. I stood at a podium in a meeting telling my story one time, and there was a girl in that meeting that I owed an amends to, and I had to go like this the whole time because I couldn't. It made me crazy. And then after the meeting, I had to go up and make the amends to her. And I didn't realize I owed the amends until I caught myself halfway through my story and realized I'm chattering to myself in my head about this situation right as I'm trying to share my story. Because there was separation between her and it was all it evolved is me being vulnerable and telling her some things I didn't want to tell her that I felt embarrassed about, and just clearing the air and expressing honestly my regret about something that had happened, and owning it. Step 10, I really liked Scott's comments of about when rather than if. You know, you can, this road of happy destiny, you can be on the right road, but if you just sit there, you're going to get run over. You know what I'm saying? Right. So this is an action. This chapter is into action. It's not into hanging out or into thinking. It's into action. And one of the things that should happen, and I think does happen in most of us, by the time we get to step 10, inventory is taking on a new light. Now it's not looking to see how we're bad or wrong or any of that stuff, really. It's just an honest recognition of who and what I am. I know that I'm a guy with an inclination towards selfishness and self-centeredness. I'm a guy that gets afraid often. I'm a guy who gets judgmental and builds cases against people. I'm a guy who's driven sometimes by self-pity when God or you don't do things my way. I'm a guy who does all of that. I'm a guy who alters reality and blows it up and is creative with the truth. I'm that guy. And because I get it that I'm that guy, I'm the self-centered, fear-driven guy, and I will always have that propensity, then step 10 and 11 is not about beating myself up for not being perfect. It's about an honest recognition of these are my tendencies. Let's correct the course so I don't get so far out that I destroy myself, so that I can keep to my purpose here, that I can keep close to the decision I made in step 3. Not perfectly. The book reminds us in chapter 5, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like, that means you're not even going to come close, anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. But the point we have here is that we're trying to grow along spiritual lines. I must try to grow along spiritual lines. I'm an avid scuba diver, and over the years I've had to learn a little bit about sharks, which is naturally for scuba divers. And there's types of sharks that the way God designed them is that they bring oxygen into their systems by keeping a flow of current over their gills that oxygenate. Then the gills are able to get the oxygen out of the water, and that's how they sustain an oxygen level in their blood. But in order to do that, they can never stop. They must constantly be moving forward. They can't stop because then the flow stops, and when the flow stops, they start to suffocate. And I think I'm that way. I think if I stop growing along spiritual lines, then the flow of God's Spirit, which must flow through me, will stop, and I will become stagnant, and I will start to suffer, and my spirit will start to wither and die. And we all know what that's like. And you know, when your spirit gets withering and dying enough, and the pain in the heart is enough, we always remember somewhere in the back of our mind, like times we'd been like that years and years ago, and how 5 shots of Jack Daniels could fix that. Right? So I must keep my spirit healthy here. And this is how we do it in step 10 and 11. I do this because I leak. I'm not, this is the weakest area in my personal program, is step 10 and 11. And I'm here to tell you that I've, really, in the last few years, I've gotten a little more disciplined about this. But I'm still nowhere near where I'd like to be. On the bottom of page 85, in italics. Oh, one more thing about step 10. Step 10 is a lot like a tea bag. It seems to work better in hot water. Yeah. Right? Right? When I'm in hot water, step 10, I'm a serious step 10 guy. When I'm not in hot water, you know, I'm a kind of a slough off the guy, you know. Oh, where have I been selfish? Not today. Let's go to sleep. Now, this is, truthfully, let's face it, there's never been a day I've been alive or I haven't been selfish to some degree, self-concerned, self-obsessed, worried about me, my feelings, my life. There's never been a day I've been alive that I haven't been like that, to some degree. I don't think there's been a day I've been alive that I haven't been dishonest to some degree about something. The little kind of petty dishonesties, like I buy a new car. I pay, say, $36,748 for it. And you see the car and you say, Bob, that's a nice car. What'd you pay for it? Well, depending upon what I think of you and how I think you'll be impressed, I might tell you, well, I paid 40 grand for that car. Because you'll think, oh, Bob's a big shot. He paid 40 grand for that car. I might, if I think you'd be more impressed with a guy and get a good deal, I'd say, oh, I spent about 30 grand for that car. And you'd think, boy, Bob's smart. He got that car for 30 grand. But to say $36,784, there's no edge to that. You don't get any, there's no leverage on that. You don't get no torque in your life with the truth. Right? Right. And when you come from a place of vacancy and not enoughness, you need torque. You need leverage. And I'll tell you, this is a little sidebar. I think one of the worst things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is try to act as if our own inadequacies and vacancies are something we should grow away from. I think it's the greatest thing I have going for me. It's what brings me to the table with God. Because you'll hear stuff in meetings that implies that this is something I should grow above, that I should not feel inadequate, that I should become whole. No. That hole is inside. The vacancy is my God vacancy. And if I lose that, and I ever get secure unto myself to not have that vacancy, then I've just pulled myself out of the ball game, right? I just put myself on the bench. That's what brings me here. It's what brings me to my sponsor. It's what brings me to my knees in the morning and at night to pray. It's what brings me to step 10 and 11. The greatest blessing I have is my vacancy, is that my not enoughness, my inadequacy, my incompleteness. In Genesis, it talks about the creation of the world, and it talks about God on the first day created this, and in the Hebrew it says and it was tov, and tov it translated in English is good, and it was good, but it's not really tov. Really means and it was complete, and then he created on the second day, created this, and it was complete. This, and it was complete. And it gets to man, it doesn't say complete. Man's not tov. Man was never created to be tov. Man was created to struggle towards enlightenment, towards God. Man was created with a God hole and a vacancy that no other creation has. See, you'll never... Deers, dogs, cats, rabbits, birds, they are tov, they are complete. They cannot misinterpret their vacancy because they have none. You'll never see a deer in the woods with a brown paper bag and a cigarette coming out of its life looking at pornos, right? You'll never see a deer doing that because a deer is tov. A deer has no illusions of filling holes. That a deer is tov. Deer is complete. You'll see people like us doing that stuff, right? Trying to misinterpret this God hole. Trying to fill up something with... what's that old country song? We looked at love for love in all the wrong places. Right. The God hole. Real quick, and I'm running out of time. Step 11 in italics suggests prayer meditation. We shouldn't be shy in the matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Okay, the book says step 11. They're about to make some definite and valuable suggestions, and then they go right into what I love what Scott called it, the 11-step inventory. This confused me for a long time. because I didn't get it till I found this passage in the 12x12. And Bill, in the 12x12, explains why they're connected. Why, when he's talking about step 11, he's talking about inventory process as an integral part of step 11. Because he says in the 12x12 that self-examination, prayer, and meditation, when taken separately, can bring much relief and benefit. But when they're logically related and interwoven, they create an unshakable foundation for life. And you see, 10 and 11 are meant to be logically related and interwoven. You can't separate them. If taken separately, as I tried to do for years, I got much benefit and relief, but there's a big difference between relief and freedom. And I'm here for freedom. I'm here because I have to have freedom, and there's only one thing I need freedom from: the bondage of self. I need to carry out the decision I made in step 3 or I'll die. We must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And that's when we interlock step 10 and 11, it is unshakable. And what it's very similar to when you combine the two exercises that are on 86 and 87, it's very similar to what a sailor would experience. Let's say you were to go down here to one of the harbors on the east coast of Florida, and you were to rent or buy the most expensive, best-equipped sailboat you could find. Money's no object. And you were to go to a nautical library, and you had the goal. You made a decision. The decision is, I'm going to sail to the island of Bermuda. And you went to the nautical library and you went through a 9-step course on setting a perfect course for the island of Bermuda. What would occur is, no matter how perfect your boat is and no matter how perfect the course you've set from the east coast of Florida to the island of Bermuda, it's just going to come to pass every single day that the winds and the tides and the currents are going to blow you and move you off course. It's not because you have a bad boat. It's not because you played with your tiller too much. It's none of that. It's just the way it is. It's not because you've done anything wrong. It is the natural condition of the realm of the spirit. Because what we bring to the realm of the spirit is a person with a propensity to self-involvement, a person who's had an inclination to play God. And that's what we're bringing to the table here. So every single day, a sailor must get out his compass and sextant and all those tools and take an honest, honest inventory. And he cannot fool himself about values. An honest inventory of where he is, and then compare it to a vision of step 3, a vision of self-abandonment and service, a vision of Bermuda, and readjust his course back to where he was going, so he can go there once and for all? No, because the next day he's going to have to do the same thing again. Right? And if you don't do that, I'll tell you what happens is, all of a sudden you're sailing along and you're wondering why you're running into these chunks of ice with penguins on them and on the way to Bermuda. And if you're really a truly self-delusional alcoholic, you'll start saying, well, you know, they must have populated Bermuda with penguins. It's just... And what happens to us is we get so far out we can't get back. And if you've been around the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for any sustained period of time, you've seen those guys. And you'll see them once in a while, that they build this tremendous house of cards out of all kinds of gratification stuff and material stuff, and then it'll collapse on them, and they have not done step 10 and 11. They are not current and connected to no power source in their life. They're not connected to their sponsor or anything else, and they will run into a discussion meeting frantic, and the chairman will say, does anybody have a problem? And they'll go like this, and they'll dump this mess of their life that is unmanageable out on the table for help. And they'll, unfortunately, if you've ever tried to get help or advice in a discussion meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like trying to take a drink of water from a fire hose. I mean, it's just... And they'll sit there, and after about 10 people have shared at them, they bolt out of the meeting. They bolt, and then the rest of the meeting will just be spinning about a problem that's left. Right? And you can get so far out, you can't get back. You can't get back because now you're too entrenched in being right. You're too entrenched in how they screwed with you. You're too entrenched in your judgments. You're too entrenched in your will. You are the center. You're running the show. You are right. You're not the guy who can be wrong. And I tell you, if you can't be wrong, sobriety's going to be hard. Because from step four all the way through, it's about how I'm wrong in my perceptions, how I'm wrong in my judgments. If you can't be wrong here, you're going to have a hard time. So that's really what this whole thing is about. And I'm actually, it's time for me to turn over to Scott, and I'll talk a little bit more about 11 when I get back.
A couple of more quotations that have meant a lot to me. This is a gift from a good friend of mine. It really changed my perspective. He says, "I work this program to the best of my willingness. I don't believe I've ever worked it to the best of my ability." Ah, boy. This is a gift from my wife. "Anxiety is really just low-grade atheism."
Yes, it is.
Another one from Miss Linda. Now, this one has nothing to do with recovery. I'm just going to try to make you laugh. That's all this is. Miss Linda is slightly dyslexic, and she's not embarrassed by it, but we do get some funny things out of it. And I was watching the U.S. Open golf tournament on TV. She was being with her husband. And you got it? It's anonymous giving is what that is. All right? It really is. And this Oriental fellow, I think he was Japanese, was in contention. He may have been in the lead at that time. He hit a particularly bad shot, and the camera comes in close on him, and you just see he's in anguish. And Miss Linda says, "Oh, I hope he doesn't commit karaoke." I hope so, too. I've been there when people have committed karaoke. It can be a terrible thing. It can last a long time, too. One of the things you may have noticed is that Bob and I give our last names here. We do that in keeping with our tradition of anonymity. If that didn't make sense to you, I'd like to recommend the pamphlet Understanding Anonymity in the book Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Really, really would. And I want to tell a story about anonymity isn't just about press, radio, and films, and we do that so that the newcomers can come in. Anonymity has another level, and that is the level of doing something good for someone and not being caught. Now, that's not my style. I'm just a little bit into the applause myself. But I had an experience a number of years ago where I had the chance to do something good for someone and not get caught, and I did it. And what happened was, I don't mean to sound poetic, but I can't describe this any better, and people are going to nod and grin when I say this, but it was like there was a piece of sunshine about the size of a golf ball that lodged itself in my chest. And I could think about what I had done any time of the day or night, and this thing would glow and send light through my whole body. See, I'm nodding? Okay. And it just didn't matter. Whatever was going on, I could just think about that, and it would just light me up. And, boy, I never told anybody about it for about 6 months. And when I told, that thing got out. It's gone now. And because there's another lesson in this story, I'm going to tell you what it was. I'm a salesman by trade, and it was one of those days where I got a full day's work done in a half a day. I had my fishing tackle on the back. I was near a city park. I'm fishing the stream, and there was a family having a picnic, and they had about an 8-year-old boy. And, boy, he locked on my leg and wanted to fish. And so I'm showing him this thing and got to talk to the family. None of them fish. And eventually I took him on a couple of short trips and got to know the family. And the Buffalo River in Tennessee is a national scenic river, and it's full of fish. And with his parents' permission, one day I put him in the front of the canoe. We floated 5 miles of river. And we floated 10 hours, and he didn't get enough, and I didn't either. And we caught over 100 fish that day. Yeah, the little guy caught a 4-pound smallmouth bass, man. He got my fish. But I'm okay. And about a mile from the takeout, the banks are steep, and there's really no place to get out of this river. And suddenly the sky darkened, and we're fixing to get it. I'm hearing the thunder. We come down kind of a chute, and we did what canoeists call eddy out. There's a little backwater. You can kind of parallel park in one of those up under the trees. Just before the bottom drops out of this baby, it's going to be raindrops the size of my thumb, right? Just before the bottom drops out, I'm sitting in the back of this canoe, and I'm just about to give God a little piece of my mind. Have you not noticed St. Scott down here with the little boy, and he caught my fish, and just about there. And this beautiful little boy looks over his shoulder at me and says, "Is it okay to fish here?" I forget. I prayed that third step prayer, and I meant it. And I forget that. And when the skies of my life darken, and the thunder's coming, and I'm fixing to catch it, it's the only thing I'm supposed to say, "Father, is it okay to fish here?" Because that's my job. That's what I signed on to do. A friend of mine getting a 24-year chip a couple of days ago, and he said, "I got to remember I don't own this business. I just work behind the counter." Yeah, I just work behind the counter. And that's the question I'm supposed to be taking to my God. Is it okay to fish here? It's a great question. Step 11 on the short form on page 59 has an implied promise, I think, and a beautiful one. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. If I'm going to improve it, I must already have it. So I believe we're promising you, if you'll do the first 10 steps with a sponsor who's already done them and do them right out of this book, that by this time you will have a conscious contact with God, as I say, of my limited understanding. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, and then I get out of the business of coaching God, of telling him what to do. And ask just, what would you have me do? Is it okay to fish here? That's the question. 60, 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result. Doesn't say a, says the. We promise a single thing. Spiritual awakening. And spiritually awakened people don't drink beverage alcohol and they don't get thirsty. I'd like to report that my wife, an 18-year member of Al-Anon, does not drink alcohol. She chooses not to. I can't choose not to. Page 25 tells me that very clearly. She chooses not to. So that her husband, who she loves dearly, doesn't have to come home and kiss burgundy wine or a martini or something on the lips coming home from a day at work. Y'all might think about that. It means an awful lot to me that she does that. And that, to me, the 12-step breaks into three parts. Promise of a spiritual awakening. And then I'm not sure the rest of that is telling me what to do so much as describing who I'm going to become. Tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all my affairs. It was my experience in step 5 that when I told all those things about myself, they became lighter. I've got some pretty ugly stuff in my past. I've shared it with some of you. When you hear me say that I don't have the power to make a mistake, God can't turn into something magnificent, I want you to know that the Master has used these worst things I've ever done as tools to help people in this room this weekend. A lot of them. I'm not taking any credit for that. I'm saying we have a powerful God. Gave us a powerful program, more powerful than the worst things I've ever done. Yeah. And I think that, so I still carry those things. I think in step 5, I think I became God's caddy. I'm still carrying those things, but they've lost their weight and stench. And part of what keeps them clean and light is my willingness for him to use them. I think if that ever goes away, then I'm in trouble. I think the weight and stench will come back. I don't know that, but I think that. The other thing is, I'm an apprenticed messenger. It says we tried to carry this message. It doesn't say we carried it. I think if I was a messenger, it'd say I carried it. It says I'm trying to carry it. I think that makes me an apprentice. And if I can hold that attitude, I'm God's caddy and I'm an apprenticed messenger. When I hold that in my heart, I do a really good job. I can be a really good channel. I'm not the living water, I'm the pipe. You know, on a good day, I'm a plumbing fixture. That's what it amounts to. And so it describes me. And I now try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all my affairs, to live a principled life, irrespective of outcome. I'm responsible simply for my actions. I think it's important. I want to talk a little bit about this chapter, Working with Others, and hit just a couple of points, and then we'll take another break. Page 93. This is, for me, really important. I want to describe something to you first. I sponsored for a while, and this is no offense to any religion or anything. I'm simply going to talk about something that's been in the news and my experience personally with it. One of the major churches had a problem with clergy and pedophiles. I sponsored one of the boys that was a victim of that. And if someone had been using specific religious terms in his first meeting, he would have hit the door, and alcohol would not have driven him back, and he would have died on the street. I today still sponsor, and I have permission to tell these, by the way, I still sponsor a fellow who was sexually abused by a deacon of a church in the church from the time he was 6 until he was about 11. And if someone had mentioned some specific religious terms in his first meeting, he would have hit the door and would not have come back. Page 93. First full paragraph. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain, that means very specific, certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. I think they were. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are. Alcoholics Anonymous is no place to try to sell us your religion. I don't want to talk to you about mine. If you ask me one-on-one, I'll answer any question you have. I'm not hiding it. This is not the right venue for that. And no offense to anyone who has a child or knows someone who's needed this, but I have a friend that calls AA spiritual special ed. It really is. I mean, this is spiritual kindergarten for guys like me that weren't getting it anywhere else. I have a learning disability known as alcoholism. There's got to be a learning disability. I mean, how could it have taken me 41 years? So I got to be careful that my own beliefs don't take away somebody else's chance to get this thing. That's why I said that thing about voting. I vote by secret ballot. We got to keep that away from here. Outside issues. And specific religious terms are outside issues also. Let's be careful with that. When I was sober about 5 years, I was sponsored by probably the most spiritual man I'll ever know. I must assume so. And I called him one day and I said, Mike, I got this question about this guy I'm trying to sponsor. What should I do? And he says, drop him. And I said, Mike, come on, I'm serious. He couldn't have meant that. He said, no, I do mean it. Drop him. I said, now, come on now. He says, I'm serious. Drop him. I'd rather have you on the golf course than working with him. Be better for your program. I said, hell, I don't understand that. And he said, what are you asking him to do that he's not doing? And I said, well, call his parole officer, look for a job, go to a meeting every day, open and close his days on 86, 87, and 88, and start his four-step. And he says, you're not doing any of that? And I said, no. He said, you are not his sponsor. He is. You are his fire chief. And when his tail feathers are ablaze, he calls you and siphons off some of your serenity and puts out his fire and goes right back to doing it his way. And you're not helping him. You're actually co-signing a lie. He said, could you stay sober on the program he's working? I said, no. He said, can he? I said, I doubt it. He said, you are probably right. And when he drinks again, you're going to have to be able to sleep knowing that you told him the truth. Because the truth is, he may be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he's doggone sure not in the program. And he doesn't have a sponsor. And you have to do that so you can sleep. Because when he goes back out, he could kill himself or somebody else or do a long stretch in prison. And you're going to have to sleep knowing that you've told him the truth. There's another reason. Then he said, how do you feel when you work with him? I said, it drains me. I feel like I've been worn out, wrung out. And he said, how about Bill Kay? How do you feel when you work with him? I said, oh, he lights me up like a pinball machine. I feel great every time I talk to him. He said, and what are you asking Bill to do that he's not doing? I said, oh, he's doing it all. Oh, really? Yeah. There's another reason I have to drop him. And it's for him. It's so that the next time he wakes up in a jail cell in a pool of his own blood and vomit, I want him to have three options. And the options are to commit suicide, to continue to live as he is living, or to try Alcoholics Anonymous knowing he has not tried it because I told him the truth. Because if I don't tell him the truth, I've signed his death warrant. Before you come disagree with me on this, I want you to read pages 95 and 96. I'm not going to go to them, but that's what it says very, very clearly. Middle paragraph on 95, top paragraph on 96. Say it's a waste of time to try to work with somebody that will not work with you. Cannot do it. Won't happen. We're going to take about a 12-minute break. We'll start again at 11 o'clock sharp.
Bob Darrow, I'm still an alcoholic. One of my inherent character defects is that I don't follow directions very well. I know that's surprising to some of you. I'm the kind of guy that I could come over to your house and you could give me a piece of carrot cake and I would eat it and think, man, that's the best. I'm going to make that carrot. Give me the recipe. And you could write out a detailed recipe and I would go and start making it and then I'd see something in there. You know, I think it'd be better if we let that out. We'll put this in instead. And I would end up with a terrible piece of carrot cake because I don't like to follow directions. And I did the same thing with the steps, and I did the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to crash and burn on several occasions. I did the same thing my first four-step. I didn't follow the directions because I did it the way my mind perceived it should be done. I'm relying on the great I am. So I wrote my life story. It was like a sort of a cross between Catholic confession and Freudian psychoanalysis. It was kind of, and nothing changed, really, you know. And then the same thing happened to me in step 11. When I got to step 11, and I'm reading this part of the book, and I you know, the when we retire at night and on awakening, okay, I get a vague thing. I'm supposed to frame my day with stuff I start my day with and stuff I end my day with. Okay, I get that. And then I started reading about, on the bottom of page 86 and the top of 87, the blow-by-blow specific directions on what I'm supposed to do. You know, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask, okay, that's a prayer. All right, I see that that's a prayer. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking. Under these conditions, we can employ God gave us prayer. And I can see like a little bit of prayer and stuff in here. But it doesn't match my view of meditation, right? See, I'm a child of the 70s, and I grew up in an era where we had we chanted a Namne Yoho Renge Kyo, we chanted Om, we did the breathing, we did the tiger, the lion, we did all that stuff. I took all those courses and did all those classes. I know a lot about meditation. No, I don't. And so I spent the first 15 or so years of my recovery trying to do all kinds of other stuff for step 11. And I never did what it said in this book because it never matched my internal view of what meditation should be. I did guided imagery. I did breathing exercises. I went to the Buddhists. I did a lot of stuff. And it's all of benefit. It's nothing wrong with any of that stuff, really. As a matter of fact, on the bottom of page 87, was it 87? No. Yeah, somewhere down. Oh, there's a, I'm not even sure where it is now. Where'd it go? Where it talks about, oh yeah. Be quick to see the last full paragraph, the last line. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they have to offer. And that's really good. But it's not in substitution for, it's in addition to, right? And I'll tell you, my whole program started to change when I started to actually do what it talks about on page 86 and 87. And a guy that I sponsor had a dictionary that was a Webster's dictionary from 1916. And in 1916 is a good, it's a good dictionary because that's about the time that Bill Wilson would have been cementing his language skills in his meaning of words. And what I discovered in looking at that dictionary is that the word, the definition of the word and the context of the word meditation had changed drastically culturally in this country in the English language in the 60s and 70s. Because of the advent of the Maharishi, transcendental meditation, guys like Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, Jay Krishnamurti, that were introducing an Eastern philosophies into our Western culture, that the view of what of meditation meant changed. So by the time I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have some preconceived notions of what meditation is, and because of that, I listen to this more than I listen to this. And so I spend many, many years here not doing here what it says in the book because it doesn't match what my internal definition of meditation is and what I think it should be. So I try all this other stuff. And it's all good. It's all good stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. But I never did this and I shorted myself. Now I do that some of that stuff in addition to this. And I'll tell you what the definition, it had many definitions in 1916, but the one that stuck out, the example that stuck out the most is it said, used the example, it said, a general doth meditate a war. Listen to what the book says. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. If I was a general and I was getting up in the morning and I had a battle in front of me, I would consider that battle for the day. I would look at my assets and my liabilities. I would ask my officers to remove the equipment that's no longer usable. I would make sure that only things, people, soldiers, and equipment went into battle that actually worked. I would try to divorce my army from the things that were handicapping it and dragging it down so that I could constructively come up with a viable plan to carry out my mission, which is to win the battle or to be relieved of the bondage of self. So that I can, and we say in the third step prayer, I ask in God to take away these difficulties with this bondage of self for one reason and one reason only, so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help, like I'm going to have to help people. That's my goal. I had a new guy say to me, I was 10 years sober, he says, we're doing a third step, and he says, you mean we're doing all this just so we can help other people? I was 10 years sober. I didn't know that. I went, oh, yeah. Oh, I thought we were trying to make Bob wonderful. So I can be more useful. And in the beginning of the 12x12, Bill says, he talks about the 12 steps, or set of principles, spiritual in nature, that can not only expel the obsession to drink, but will give the sufferer a life where he's happily and usefully whole. And you're not happily and usefully whole until you're carrying out your primary purpose, until you've allowed the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to do their work so that you can step up and claim your inheritance and be the guy who helps God's kids. That's what I'm here for. That's my job. I get sidetracked from it all the time, all the time. I think it's about me. I think it's about a new car. I think it's about this. I think it's about that. It's not about any of that. It's about crafting myself to be of use to God and to the other people around me. So, on awakening, I consider the 24 hours ahead. I consider my plans for the day. I do this now every morning. I ask God to divorce my thinking of the things that will handicap me. Throughout my day, I ask him to divorce my thinking from self-pity. You know, when my will gets back in there and things don't go my way and I start to feel sorry for myself, you're a person, when I'm full of self-pity, I am useless. Because one of the promises in the step nine, it says that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. It doesn't say that feeling of uselessness and that feeling of self-pity. Feeling of uselessness and self-pity, they're the same thing. When you're useless to anyone else, you're full of self-pity. You can't be useful and feel sorry for yourself at the same time. It's absolutely impossible. So I'm asking God to take away this uselessness. This self-pity, divorce my thinking from dishonest or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. Now, and this was a novel thought to me. It said, for after all, God gave us brains to use. I tell you, I spent my first 10 years of sobriety, 15 years of sobriety, I tell you about how my brain was my enemy. That this could be a useful tool. And it is. My mind is a great tool. It's a terrible master. But it's a great tool. Really is. I'll tell you, it's the best thing I have to recount experiences that are useful to the guys I sponsor. It's a great tool. It's just when it runs the show, it's like a defensive computer. When it's in charge, it just runs scenarios of problems that haven't even occurred yet I'm trying to solve. You know, just on and on and on and on. It's a defensive mechanism, which I think is what allowed us to survive the jungles and the dinosaurs and all that other stuff. We grew this tumor up here that would eventually defend. It's a defensive tumor that defends us from this world that's hostile. But when it runs my life, it's a bad deal. But it's a tremendous tool. Tremendous. Tremendous. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. When my thinking is cleared of self, my thinking becomes other-centered, God-reliant, not self-reliant, not fear-driven, but love-enhanced. In thinking our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. That's hard for some of us. In my early sobriety, I'd go to my sponsor and I'd be crazy. I'd be nuts. And I'd start telling him about all this stuff. And he'd say, but is everything okay right this moment? Well, yeah, but by next week I'm going to lose my apartment, and it's coming. But right this second, is everything all right? Well, yeah, right now it's okay. But I'll tell you, I'm going to eventually have to go to prison, and it's going to be awful. But right this minute, yeah, right this minute it's okay. But see, I get this brain tumor; I can feel it, and it's going to. And he said, but right this second, is everything all right? Well, yeah. Good. When it's no longer okay, right this second, you and I will have some stuff to deal with. But as long as it's okay. And he was trying to center me with where God is, where reality is, right now. Right now. So to relax and take it easy. I'm a guy I've pushed on life all my life. I've had that edge in me. I've fought the clock. My first many years of sobriety, I was uptight all the time. Fighting the clock, fighting, racing around in traffic, just fighting, 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 fighting. As if time itself were my enemy. And time is my friend. If you relax and take it easy, you know all the things that you've fought to try to get will just come to you. Just come to you. If you can relax and take it easy. God's will flow through your life. You don't have to go out and beat yourself half to death to find it. It will come to you. That's the gift. That's the promise. The whole thing from the obsession to drink, being removed, and us being placed in a position of neutrality, it just happens automatically to visions of God's will in our life, to intuitive thoughts and actions, to feelings of love and perceptions of other-centeredness. Just will come if you can relax and take it easy. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. The great psychiatrist Carl Jung believed in something that is very spiritual in nature, but he looked at it from an academic, scientific point of view. He called it the collective unconscious. And what that was is he believed in every human being was a connection or a portal to the consciousness of the whole planet. That almost as if there was a blocked portal in me that connected to the hard drive of the universe. And out of that collective unconsciousness is the ultimate knowledge of everything I would ever, ever need to know. The problem is from the moment of birth, I start throwing stuff over that portal and blocking the portal. It says the same thing in the big book. It says deep down within us. It calls it the great reality, deep down within us. What if that's true, then within me is the ultimate godlike knowledge of everything I would ever need to know. How to conduct my life, how to interact with people, where to go, what to do, how to say. It is there's a flow in this universe that if I could tap into it, I would be hitting on 12 cylinders all the time. The problem is I can't do that. I'm handicapped by obstinacy. I'm handicapped by the clamors of the world. I'm handicapped by my own self-centeredness and my own fear. And just to the extent that I do that, do I connect with that intuitive thing? And if you're sober for a while, you've had those moments where you just get that intuitive. Sometimes, and it's knowledge greater than you or your experience. You can actually make leaps and bounds in consciousness that is beyond you. We've all had those experiences. Sometimes working with a new guy and they're struggling and they're in a lot of pain, and you will find yourself, as I've done on many occasions, saying to them things I don't know that I know. Things that are above and beyond me. And I tell you, that is not me. I am not that smart. That is something flowing through me, because as I'm loving this guy and concerned with him, I'm other-centered enough to be out of the way. I am no longer blocking the channel. And it flows through me. That is not me, but it comes through me. So this is exciting stuff. I'll never get there, but the prospect of knowing that that's alive within me, and if I can keep working at this, at times I will be inspired. At times I will be a channel. At times the God within me will shine through. And I get to be present and watch that. I get to be a witness to his hand working through me in people's lives. It ain't me. But to be present of that. See, I'm a taker. I'm a user of people. I'm a parasite. I'm a self-obsessed guy who is... And to be able to be present and actually be an instrument is an amazing thing for me. I get to be a tool, sometimes in helping people. It's incredible. But there's a caution here. And it says, being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. And it says, we might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. And oh man, do we do that, I'll tell you. Oh, it's... Because it's... You know, if you're selfish, self-centered, self-concerned, self-absorbed like I am, and you come to AA and you listen to the miracle stories, and you know, how many times do you have to hear the story of, oh, I was going to be homeless and I couldn't get a job and I finally turned it over and now I'm the head of a big corporation. Oh, okay. I'm here with you now. God, I really turned this over. Where's my Bentley? Right, or that self is such a strong force in my life, and this ability to self delusion, which means I am deluded about life to the point where I start imagining that God's will is real, my will is really God's will. Instead of aligning my will to God's, I imagine through this psychotic wishful thinking that God has now aligned his will with mine. Right? And it's like, this is crazy stuff that in early sobriety, pulled up to a meeting and there was a parking space in front of the meeting and God picked that for me. because I'm so special. Selfish, self-centered, it's all about me. No, I don't know. Maybe God picked it for me. Maybe, you know, maybe if he really gave it to me, what I'd do is I'd wait till somebody who really needed it and I'd just give it to them. Right? But no, it's my parking space. God gave that to me. Right? One of my greatest experiences with this stuff, there's a guy named George who's sober now 20-some years and he lives over in Germany. And when George was 3 months sober, we're out to coffee, about a half dozen of us in a restaurant after a meeting, and we're talking about God and God's will and everything. And George wants to share this. He says to us, he says, you know, I really know now that God loves me. I said, that's good, George. How do you know that? And he says, well, he says, God knew that I didn't have much self-esteem, so he put these two newcomer girls in my life to sleep with so I'd feel better about myself. And we're falling out of our chairs. I think this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And George is looking at me like, what? That's God's will. He believed that. I tell the guys I sponsor, if you got a good idea, call me. If you have a great idea, come and see me. If God has spoken to you and given you direction, you better get your hell ass over here right away. Right? And that's why I have a sponsor. I'm 26, almost 26 and a half years sober. I got a sponsor. I bounce my ideas off of him. Some of you guys know the story of Jim Jones. I think Jim Jones had alcoholism. Jim Jones had a big problem, drugs and alcohol. Jim Jones had a born-again experience. Not uncommon. Alcoholics throughout the ages have had those. And he got sober and he got a calling. He went to divinity school. He did a calling to be a minister and do God's work. And he did. He I think for a number of years, I think Jim Jones was a very spiritually connected guy. I really do. He helped a lot of people. In the inner city, man, he's still in those areas. People talk about the good he did down there. But Jim Jones had no one to bounce a vision of God's will off of except the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And incrementally, the self reasserted itself subtly. And self can use spiritual principles. I've seen members of Alcoholics Anonymous that have found ways that profit off of AA. Self has reasserted itself in their life. And AA to them becomes self-grandizing. They become, under the guise of spirituality, they become users here of people. And that propensity, unsponsored, is in all of us. And Jim Jones self-reasserted itself in himself gradually, incrementally, slowly, inch by inch, it moved him. And he never saw the journey. He never got it. If he'd had a sponsor, I'm sure at the very least his sponsor would have said, Jim, the Kool-Aid's a bad idea. You know, really? But this is crazy. But you move far enough, bizarre, absurd things seem like a good idea. I think Jim Jones killed himself and had those thousands of people down in Ghana thinking he's doing God's will. Now that sounds bizarre. That's not so crazy. I hear the things that some of the guys I sponsor come to me with, this is God's will. No, she isn't. But she's 3 weeks sober. She drank the same kind of wine I did. Don't you get it? Yeah. It's God's will for me to make amends to my ex. No, you don't want to go over there. Well, I need to really tell her how sorry I am. Send her the child support. You don't want to go over there and make amends. We know what you want to do, right? You want to write more checks you can't cash. Send her the child support. And yet the book says, nevertheless, we find that as our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration, we come to rely on it. In the 12x12, it talks about even the most spiritual men will always check their vision of God's will with someone else. Loose cannons eventually go over the side, right? I don't want to be a loose cannon here. I need to be tethered. I need to be in the hands of. I need to have accountability to someone who believes in spiritual principles more than my self-interest. Because ultimately, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I must subjugate and push aside self and serve an ethic and a set of principles that are higher than I am, really. That's what we do here, ultimately, is we push ourselves. We spend our whole life serving self, concerned with self, gratifying self, securing self, making self happy. And how's that working for you? So we push that aside and we come here and we serve a set of principles before our own personality, really. That's, I think, it's step or tradition number 12. It says principles before personalities. It's not the principles of AA I put ahead of your personalities. There's only one personality here who wants me dead. That's me. There's only one personality here that's the seat of all my conflict and judgment. That's me. I'm the personality I must apply these principles against. My natural inclination to run the universe. That's why in the book it says on several occasions things that didn't make sense to me for a while. There's a line in step 11, it says we must constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. And I'm sober 17 years or so, and I'm reading that thinking, now why are they saying we must constantly do that? And I got it, because I'm constantly trying to run the show. It is my inclination to judge. It's my inclination to control, to be play God in my life. It's my natural, left unchecked. It's the way I will always go. I will always go back that way. Left unchecked without the discipline of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, we are alcoholics, page 88, are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. Step 12, carrying this message, is really the actualizing factor where God will be able to relieve you of the bondage of self. There is nothing else here that will do that. If you want to get goosed by the Spirit, you got to get up off your ass. You can't be relieved. You can chant and do meditation and prayer and read spiritual literature unto yourself to the end of your days, and you will not overcome self. It'll become all about you. And this I know guys in AA that instead of doing this, they've gone to India and studied under the great masters. And I know a gal that did that, and that didn't work. And then she went to China and became a certified Buddhist priestess. And she's not trying to become of more service. She wants to rise above everybody else. Right? My work is right here. Right on this planet. Right in the trenches down on Skid Row and in the clubhouses where the new guys are coming in and they're shaking and they're scared and they have no hope. That's where I'm supposed to be. That's where I've been divinely crafted to be of helpful, to be helpful, to be useful. That is my purpose. And step 12, it says, nothing so much will ensure immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. It works where other activities fail. It works where all other activities fail. It works where going to meetings fails. It works where calling your sponsor fails. It works where praying fails because you can't connect. You're too self-consumed. It works where meditation fails. It works where reading spiritual literature fails. It works where all other activities fail. When I have me and my emotions and my life on me like this, the only thing that will relieve me of the bondage of self is two things. 5 shots of Jack Daniels are other-centered concern and action. And the only thing that will do that to me is to throw me in the arena of helping others. It's the only thing that relieves a guy like me of the bondage of self. Scott?